This week has made me think a lot about power. Who has it? Why? And how power structures shape our world. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. We've seen a lot of people wrestling with who should hold power this week. The GOP is reckoning with that in the election. Brazil is on its way to ousting its president from power. And Facebook has become increasingly powerful in shaping the news we see. And how we feel about that still seems unsettled. We have stories this week that delve into power dynamics, about some of the things I just mentioned, but also the power of laying out what you want to leave behind you when you die, and how much power we might be ceding to robots in our working lives. Come talk to us anytime on Marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. This week we are starting, as we often do, with our segment Long and Short, when we steal those terms from the world of finance and ask our panelists to bet on or against various things in the world of news and business. This week we have Mike Isaac, tech reporter for the New York Times, and Marketplace's own senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
All right, Mike, let's start with you. Why don't you give us your long?
Okay, so my long is on Uber's deal that they just made this week. They've sort of agreed to this kind of quasi-union for drivers in New York. So essentially it gives drivers a bunch of little things like, you know, discounts on insurance or the ability to speak to Uber, but it does not give them the ability to collectively bargain for higher pay. The reason I'm long on it is essentially it's Uber bending enough to say, okay, we're going to start listening to drivers, but we're not going to call you employees. And I think this is honestly going to sort of get the employee rights hawks off their back for at least a little while.
But doesn't it suggest that they also don't have the money to pay their drivers anymore and that they might eventually run out of drivers?
I do. Well,
I agree that I'm long on the pacification, but maybe not the business plan.
All right, Molly, what are you long?
I'm long on quinoa. I am long on quinoa as the new kale because not only is it such a Northern California thing to say, but there are increasingly successful efforts to grow quinoa in Northern California. And so the only thing that could make quinoa even better for Northern California hippies like me is if it were locally sourced. You guys.
But wait a minute. Quinoa grows in the Andes, naturally. Northern California, I mean, we're not talking about the same climate, are we?
Not really, although the Northern California climate is friendly to a lot of things. There have been a lot of failed experiments to try to get quinoa to grow well here. And now those experiments seem to be successful. So there are about 800 acres. It's not just Northern California. It's actually West Coast production overall. There's been a lot of sort of conflicting feelings about getting quinoa from the Andes, where it has disrupted the local economy and it's made quinoa unaffordable for some of the native Andean tribes that used to use it as a food staple. So if you could add a locally grown component, it's quinoa nirvana.
I think it's total fad. I think Big Kale tried to make kale a thing for a long time. Now kale is on the wane. It's a fad, you know?
If there starts to become like a venture-backed quinoa consortium of any sort, then I will definitely short quinoa. But for now, locally sourced and grown quinoa, I am all over that, like white on rice.
Okay, Mike, what's your short, man?
So in New York this week, there was a big story on this pizza shop owner who creates pizza boxes.
Ew.
Imagine ordering your pizza and it being delivered to you inside of a pizza. I think this stuff is not only disgusting, but it's like these food-related gimmicks. They get headlines for a week. You know, the Times wrote about it, a bunch of different things. Do I want to eat a pizza that's been put on a counter anywhere in New York or in the backseat of some dude's, you know, Honda Civic? I don't think so. So I am like short on these being an actual sort of viable long-term marketing vehicle.
Well, so what does this tell us that the headlines are all about gimmicks and not about the underlying product? Is anybody doing well?
If you look at McDonald's, you know, they've done the same thing for years and years. Now they're trying to get people in the door because sales are sort of waning. So they have like salads, they have wraps, they killed the salad. So I think it's really, you know, how do a lot of these chains try to reinvent themselves? A lot of these products are super gross, with the exception of Taco Bell. Seems to be doing pretty well.
I mean, I think we're missing the obvious solution for all of these restaurants, and that is quinoa.
oh my God, the quinoa bowl is bad.
But I would say the underlying problem, like you said, Lizzie, is that the food is gross and it's bad for you. And so I think people are starting to sort of catch on to that, other than Taco Bell, where the food is delicious and bad for you. And somehow Taco Bell plus marketing plus millennials is like gold.
I'm glad we have two tech people on for this next thing, which is Molly's short, because I think you guys disagree on this.
Yeah, so I am short on Facebook as a media giant and news gatekeeper. Mm. So obviously there was controversy this week about whether Facebook's in-house editorial team is actually censoring links to conservative news content. That led to this overarching discussion about Facebook as the new gatekeeper, the new way that we consume news. And yes, we have seen a lot of media companies rush headlong into trying to please Facebook in the name of engaging new readers and viewers and listeners and whatever it is. In fact, some of them, including the New York Times, are getting paid to make video, live video for Facebook. But I feel like we have seen this happen in the media business before. I lived through the SEO years, the SEO wars, where everybody was chasing those Google clicks. Mm. Facebook has an outsized amount of control right now. But I do not believe that they will dictate the future of all media.
Why not?
Honestly, because no one else has, ever.
I think that's a great point. And these things end up killing themselves. I also think that Zuckerberg knows that as well and sort of has tried to think about how do we, you know, I'm going to sound totally valley right now, but how do we disrupt ourselves? What is going to be the next Facebook? What is going to be these sort of platforms that we should own before anyone else is going to beat us to it?
The question that I find really fascinating here is looking at the government response. There are members of Congress who are trying to treat Facebook like a quasi-public utility, which it is not. It is a company. And so that makes me wonder, like, how do you regulate that? Do you regulate that?
Well, I mean, I think those are the questions that will start to potentially chip away at the empire, right, in the empire building. Empires are hard to build and maintain. They've always been hard to build and maintain. And Zuckerberg is a smart guy with a very long and far-reaching vision. But even he doesn't know what the next generation is going to want.
Marketplace's Molly Wood, Mike Isaac from the New York Times. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Hi, it's Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening to Marketplace Weekend. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. Here's some context on us. Since we're a nonprofit, we rely on donations from our listeners to keep going. Your gift in any amount will be automatically doubled this month thanks to the generosity of Newman's Own Foundation. And we just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. Donate today at marketplace.org. Next week, Congress is set to vote on plans to ramp up funding to fight the Zika virus. And as the weather turns warmer, Zika is spreading, not just in South and Central America, but in Puerto Rico and starting to arrive on the U.S. mainland. Marketplace's Andy Euler has been covering Zika and the back and forth over funding a public health response. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Lizzie.
So Congress reached a deal this week on Zika funding, right? What's in it?
Yeah, Washington did come to a deal. It's $1.1 billion. It's a package to fight the virus. It's weird because it's sort of a win for Dems, but in February, the president asked Congress to set aside about $2 billion to respond. And he's essentially saying that we need to help prepare for what looks like an inevitable spread here on the mainland. Now, some Republicans said the White House was asking for too much money, so you could see the deal as a win for them. But even before the measure, there was a bit of money shuffling happening as the president already shifted about $600 million that was initially from a fund set up to fight Ebola. So there's a lot of money kind of trying to be allocated. To date, we've seen about 500 cases of the virus on the mainland, nearly 700 in Puerto Rico, a place that, you know, I like to talk about a lot. But it's also a place that doesn't have a whole lot of money to throw around, given its debt crisis.
Yeah, you've been saying the mainland, I think, because you've been in such a sort of Puerto Rico reporting mode. But
that's right.
there have been major repercussions on the island because of the virus, yeah?
That's right. Major League Baseball was going to play a couple of games there in San Juan at the end of this month between the Miami Marlins and the Pittsburgh Pirates. Now, Miami has a ton of Puerto Rican natives living there. The game is wildly popular on the island, so the MLB thought it would, you know, be a good opportunity to get there and embrace some fans. What happened was some of the players on both teams said they didn't want to play in Puerto Rico because they were concerned about getting infected. The first death from Zika of an American citizen came in February, and it was a 70-year-old Puerto Rican man. Now, the Puerto Rican governor came out and said, as he put it, the players were using Zika as an excuse for not coming to Puerto Rico and contributing to the economy. It would have actually been the first Major League Baseball game in San Juan since 2010, and it would have also been on ESPN, so that's a big deal. The governor also said there's more likelihood of catching Zika in Miami than in Puerto Rico, though I'm not exactly sure where he's getting his numbers.
There's also the question of Zika being found more widely and some of these mosquitoes being found more widely than was initially estimated. Mm-hmm. Questions about the Pacific Northwest, the Northeast, where I am. Does the CDC have the money it needs for funding an emergency in those states, maybe in a broader geographical area than it thought it might have to deal with before?
That's the big question. Not really. I mean, the same thing tends to happen when we have an outbreak of anything. We saw it with Ebola a couple of years ago, and that shifting of money from Ebola to Zika, some public health officials are saying could leave holes in our ability to respond to something in the future. Now, public health experts are saying that we're not set up to respond to an emergency like this, and Congress tends to pass these emergency funding measures, which is exactly what we essentially came to an agreement with here this week.
So where does that leave people who are wondering, okay, well, what am I supposed to do?
That's one of the most annoying things about this case, is that it's the same thing we see with West Nile, the same thing we see with malaria. The Centers for Disease Control say it recommends that if you're traveling to Puerto Rico or to Central and South America, even, you know, now here in the Northeast, you should protect yourself from mosquito bites. It sounds like a pretty sophisticated approach to combating this thing. But public health officials argue that funding these sorts of things is different than funding something like a response to an earthquake or a flood, because they can actually help stop these disasters from happening, because if they get out in front, they might be able to make sure it doesn't become an epidemic. But again, to do that, they need a ton of money. And so this agreement, you know, $1.1 billion isn't anything to scoff at, obviously, but I know a lot of public health officials are saying, look, we just don't have enough money to even get out in front and combat this.
Marketplace's Andy Euler, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
2 weeks ago, we asked you to write or call with your stories and questions about wills, and so many of you responded that we wanted to devote another week to this. Here's listener Adam Krause. His mother died just about a year ago. He says she left a will that was really helpful, but here's the thing. He doesn't have a will yet.
It's just one of those things that I know it's important, but just the little day-to-day things in my life, they always seem to bubble up and get in the way of that sort of thing.
You wrote to us that last year your mother died unexpectedly while on vacation, but she did have a will. So how did all of that shake out, and I guess what did you learn in that process?
I think one of the most important things that I learned was, how important it was to have that sort of stuff in order. She always communicated to me how she, had preparations for if she had passed away, and she was kind of a worrier in that way. But I didn't realize until she did pass away just how useful it was.
You've noticed that she sort of encouraged you and your brother to do this, and your reply was like, okay, yeah, Mom, we got you, we hear you.
Right.
Why do you think it's so hard to have these conversations?
You know, I really think that there's just that sort of, there's that morbidity of talking about death, especially, when you're younger, you don't really think about it as much until it's close to you, like a close family member. But it really, yeah, it's something that I think just in general, people don't feel comfortable talking about that sort of thing. And there's also, I think for some people, a financial aspect as well. You don't just go and get a will drafted. You have to talk to a lawyer and there's fees involved.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, Allison Hurd's grandmother also passed away. But she says the wording of that will made things difficult when dealing with the rest of the family.
When My grandmother had passed. She had named her two youngest of her five children as executors. And that was widely known in the family that that was going to happen. It was, you know, basically because of the personalities in the family. And, you know, the youngest had stayed at home for such a long time. So it was all agreed that that would be kind of a wise choice. And the second youngest had been the most, like, financially stable and local. So that seemed to be, you know, a well-understood, wise decision. But when she passed, you know, she had had this no contest clause written into her will, which nobody had known and had, I guess, had been fairly common in a kind of a generic will way. I'm not sure. I mean, this is what I learned during that experience, that if anybody who's involved in the estate contests what the executors are doing, you lose your stake, basically.
What would you say to other people when, you know, they're thinking about putting together a will or having these kinds of conversations about what they want to have happen after their death?
I would say you have to really be honest with your family emotionally, and you have to really imagine what you want to happen afterwards and really understand how to make that happen and put that in your will. I think if she had put a lot more information into her will and put a lot more specific instructions, a lot of things could have been. It was just too vague. It was too vague for any situation.
Well, Allison Hurd, thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
I appreciate it. And if somebody else can hear what happened, I hope that it doesn't happen to one other person. Grief is on its own is a huge monster. So dealing with grief and the legal process at the same time, I mean, that just makes so much, it takes so much of your life. And you never expected to. You never expected that to happen.
We also wanted to answer more of your questions. So CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger is back to tell us more about wills, estates, and trusts. Thanks for coming back on.
Great to be with you.
I want to throw you some of the questions we got from listeners on Facebook.
Okay.
One is, at what level of financial stability do you need to have a will?
I would say this. If you have stuff and you want that stuff to go to someone in particular, you should have a will. And that can mean anything from, hey, you know, I've got a lot of stuff. I've got an heirloom of the family. And gosh, if I were to die, I'd really want my sister's kids to have it. Or if you have something that's really important to you that you just want to see go somewhere specifically. So your instructions are kind of really come front and center. You obviously need a will if you have any dependents. I mean, that's beyond even think, like, if you're dead broke, you still need to have a will to really talk about what happens to the kids in the event that you and your spouse were to die together. And, you know, I think there are many people who will go through life and say, well, I don't need a will. I've got a 401k and that passes by contract, right? There's a beneficiary assigned.
Yep.
Or I've got a life insurance policy. But again, if you've got stuff and you want that stuff to go somewhere, you've got to tell the court where it should go.
What's the difference between a will and a trust, and I guess the scenarios in which you'd use them?
A will is basically saying, you know, kind of here's what I want might happen to my stuff. The trust document is think of it almost like it's a separate account, right? So you've got an individual account with some stuff in it. You got your 401k account, and then you can have something called a trust account. And the trust account would hold assets. Now, while you're living, you can change it. That's called a revocable trust. And upon your death, it becomes irrevocable. Nothing can change. The trust is a way to convey assets much more specifically than a will. And there are all different kinds of trusts. There's a trust that you use to take advantage of the estate tax laws. There's a trust that you can use where you want to give assets to two generations down the line. There's trusts that you can use to put your house in. So what a trust is basically doing is it's like a separate legal entity, and it even has its own tax ID number after you die. The other kind of trust that's created during your life, if you want to have an irrevocable trust during your life, you're putting assets into that trust and it's not changeable. And so you might hear a lot of people talk about a irrevocable trust. They put assets in a trust. I want to get the house out of my name. That all sounds well and good because maybe you're going to qualify for assistance later and you don't want to deplete all your assets. But once those assets go into that irrevocable trust, the non-changeable type, wow, you lose them. You're done. So I think trusts are types of vehicles that we see used for specific purposes. And by and large, for most people, you need three documents when you do your estate plan. You need your will. You need a durable power of attorney. Hey, I can't make a financial decision. Someone's going to have the right to do that. And that, by the way, is really smart to do anyway, because let's say you broke your back and you couldn't write checks. You need someone to do that. So that's a durable power of attorney. And then you've got a healthcare proxy.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
One thing we realized while talking to all of you, we are not so great at talking about death. Mortician and author Caitlin Dowdy sat down with our producer Raghu Manavalan to talk about what she's learned through her work.
We absolutely live in a death-denying culture. People are terrified not only of writing wills, but of writing advance directives, of figuring out what they want done with their body. It's almost like if they speak its name, death will be called to their house. It will grace their doorstep if they talk about it.
What do you think that is?
I think a couple things happened. I would attribute it to three things that happened in the Western world. First thing that happened is that hospitals came in and took the dying out of the house and put them in the hospital. Then funeral homes came in and took death and the dead body out of the homes. And then the industrial slaughter industry came in and took all of killing of the farm animals out of the home or the ranch or the farm. And so all of a sudden, all this death that used to be a part of the family is now, poof, gone. We don't see any dead bodies. We don't see dying happening. We don't see the animals that we eat being killed. And death is just gone from our daily lives. And if we don't have any proof that death is real, how can we really understand it? I was in South Sulawesi in Indonesia this summer, and with their dead, they mummify them and they bring them out every 3 years, redress them, take family portraits, walk them around the village, and death is a constant conversation and a constant part of life. So, and then you put that up on the internet or talk about it in the United States, and they go, oh, that's disgusting, that's horrifying, it's disrespectful. And it's like, who are you to say what's respectful? They would think it's very disrespectful to hide away our dead as if they were dirty or unclean or going to come back and attack you postmortem or whatever it is. It's a really different way of looking at death and mortality.
Okay, so we're going to move on to another big life moment now. It's wedding season, which can be pretty costly. So we wanted to talk about how some of that money gets spent. For those of you who have already gotten married, tell us about some of the gifts you asked for and why. What gift do you actually still use, or what's the most unusual thing someone gave you? Give us a call at 1-800-648-5114 or leave a note on our Facebook page. Just search for Marketplace Business News. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend.
Whoops, can you say that again? Do you want to play a game or talk some more?
I really like clothes.
Definitely. What's the point if it's not fun? Uh-oh, I can't find a Wi-Fi network.
That's journalist Richard Waters from the Financial Times trying to chat with the Hello Barbie. It's a Barbie that uses Wi-Fi and speech recognition tools to talk, tell jokes, try to have a nice conversation. Obviously, there are still a few kinks. The Barbie, though, is part of the next big thing the tech industry is trying to tackle, building smart robots that are really a part of our lives. The FT explored this in a series called Robots, Friend or Foe? So we brought Richard Waters on to talk about what he found. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Give me a little bit of an overview about what exists in the realm of robot or digital assistant. You know, who's making what?
Well, I think the short answer right now is everybody is trying to make everything. There's an explosion of experimentation going on around language, and it's just a fascinating time. And I think there are two reasons for this. One is text messaging. You know, we're all spending so much of our time now in chat apps. It might be Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp or whatever. But we're used to these keyboards and we're sending little messages backwards and forwards. You know, a lot of companies have worked out that maybe we can just interact with artificial intelligence this way. Why don't, you know, if we have a question, rather than pick up the phone and call a customer service line, let's just send a message out on our chat system. And some chatbot out there will pick it up and respond. So I think that's one reason. That's where the audience is. The other is voice. Voice is one of these long dreams of technology that computers will actually understand what we're saying. And it's an incredibly hard problem. Well, there have been some huge leaps there in the last couple of years. And so now with smartphones and other kind of microphone-based systems, everyone's trying to kind of pick up our voices and understand us and send something back. And so you're seeing all this experimentation.
You played with a bunch of different digital assistants, as did some of your colleagues. What'd you find?
Well, they don't basically work right now. I mean, the problem here is the technology is so ambitious. You've essentially got four or five hugely advanced technologies you've got to stitch together to make one of these things. You need speech recognition, you know, which is just simply understanding the sounds and turning it into words. You need natural language processing. That's the really, really hard piece here, because that's understanding all the words and what they mean together. Language doesn't really have rules. And if it does, you know, we humans break them all the time. And for computers to understand that is just so hard. And then once it thinks it's understood what you're saying, it has to find something relevant to give back to you. So it's like a kind of super Google. It's got to be the most intelligent search engine that can just pick that one answer and give it to you from wherever. So it's a really, really hard problem.
Google has been experimenting with this stuff for a while. And you talked with their senior director of product management. Her name is Aparna Chennapragada. And I want to play what she had to say and then talk about it.
It's the wild, wild west. Everyone's trying to figure out, like, what is the right modality? People really got very, very familiar with, you know, accessing information on the web and, you know, using browser to kind of do things that they never could do in, you know, before that. So I see that kind of a step function change in how people will actually react and interact with computing. But I also see a lot of experimentation needed to get to the next steps here.
This idea of experimentation needed, I'm curious whether we have the patience for that, because let's say you try something with one of these robotic assistants and it doesn't work the way you want it to. Is there an appetite out there for us to try again?
You know, I think that the fortunate thing for these tech companies is that we humans are all in a massive phase of experimentation as well. You know, we're used to picking up our phones and just trying different things. You know, people tell us download an app and try it out, and we do. So we're like a giant test bed for technology companies. I think when we try something and it doesn't work, it turns us off for a while. And so when Apple introduced Siri, which was its attempt 3 or 4 years ago to give you a question and answer system, you could just pick up and ask anything, it didn't really work. And I think it turned people off the idea of talking to their smartphones for a while. But guess what? I think we're all ready again. And I think if, you know, as soon as you have that aha moment, that first thing that really gives you something smart back, I think we'll all be addicted.
So when you talk to someone at Google or some of these other companies, you spend some time talking with them, what are the things that they're kind of working on now to try to get this stuff to the next level?
Well, they all have massive user bases. They've got hundreds of millions of users. And what they're trying to do is find the right interaction method. You know, how exactly do you want to communicate with these things? And if they get it right, and here's the really intriguing thing, I think they all think they're going to have the next big interaction with computers. And so just as we all got hooked on smartphones and apps, this will be the next big thing. It'll be the thing that you just pick up and talk to, or don't even pick it up. It'll be something in the corner of the room you talk to. And so this is what they're hoping for, that, you know, they can just find that one little thing that makes you want to talk to your computer. And once they get that breakthrough, it'll be big.
Earlier, we heard the sound of the Barbie that could talk to you. And I guess I'm thinking, if you're a 7-year-old captivated by a Barbie who talks to you, are you willing to buy and spend more on that kind of technology when you're 15, 20, 25?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. What we're about to experience is another generational shift in computing. The idea of talking to an object and getting it to respond to you is so captivating. I think the generation of children now will grow up with that, and they will look back. They'll never use a keyboard. They'll hardly ever use touchscreens. They'll just interact much more directly. And so I think you're absolutely right. I think this is the beginnings. It is only the beginnings, but it's the beginnings of a, you know, what could be a very big shift.
This is all under the rubric of this FT series, Robots, Friend or Foe. With this technology, where do you come down on that?
And this is about automation. This is automating information, helping you get something done so much quicker by just taking out a lot of the interim steps. You no longer have to go to a search engine, search through the results, find the one you need, and so on. This is trying to take all of that out of the process. Like a lot of these automation technologies, which is what robotics is, the benefits are tremendous if it works. But it does two things. Yes, we know it puts people out of jobs. It takes out a lot of the work, which is both good and bad. It also presents you with answers. It takes away a certain amount of choice and human direction, because the machines in the background are anticipating, deciding, presenting things to you. When that works, the potential is huge. But it also suggests that, you know, we won't be making all those decisions. The machines in the background will. And, you know, we don't yet know who's programming the machines, what they're being programmed to do. And, you know, I think it'll take us decades to decide how we want to control all of that.
Richard Waters is the FT's West Coast editor. Thank you very much.
It's been great talking to you.
This week, Brazil's Senate voted to begin an impeachment trial for President Dilma Rousseff. It was less than 2 years ago that Rousseff was elected by a majority of Brazilians. But since then, the country's economy went into meltdown. Brazil's credit was downgraded to junk. 10 million people are unemployed, and the country's wealth shrunk by over 4%. So how did Rousseff lose so much power so fast? From our partners at the BBC, Daniel Gallis reports from the state of Maranhão, one of the poorest parts of the country, and also the state where Rousseff got her best results in the election.
It may sound like some sort of celebration, but this is actually a protest by angry teachers in São Luís, one of the poorest state capitals in Brazil. They commissioned a song that is being played in front of the mayor's office. It complains about the low wages teachers get in Brazil, which are set by politicians. Brazil had 10% inflation last year, the highest in the past 13 years. That has gotten lots of unions out into the streets in hundreds of cities up and down the country, demanding pay rises. Here in São Luís, teachers are asking for a 13% wage increase. Many in Brazil accuse President Dilma Rousseff's government of setting policies that got inflation to where it is. But despite the anger with politicians and the economy, these teachers stand by President Dilma Rousseff.
A questão do impeachment é uma questão política.
The question of impeachment is a political dispute between parties. It shows that workers across the country are the ones who will suffer from her impeachment. Their wages will be frozen, and they will lose some of their hard-won rights.
Union leader Elizabeth Castelo Branco says impeaching Rousseff under allegations that she masked Brazil's budget deficit is not the solution to the crisis.
If we're going to impeach the president, then let's impeach all mayors and governors who steal money from health and education. Let's impeach all corrupt politicians in this country. So who will be left to run the country? After she goes, nothing will change, because all the corrupt politicians will still be running the country.
Here in the state of Maranhão, 78% of the people voted for Dilma Rousseff in the last elections. In the northeast, the poorer of all Brazil's five regions, the president still enjoys some support. While 61% of Brazilians support the impeachment according to one poll, here in the northeast, only 21% back the idea. Still, the economic crisis is biting hard up here, and many who voted for her in the past now want her to go.
Before the crisis, I was making fairly good money. I could pay the installment on my car before the due date. Now I'm falling behind in all my payments. There simply aren't enough customers anymore. The crisis is so severe, I am now thinking about selling my car.
Cab driver Antonio Luis Casanova used to spend the whole morning driving passengers around. He has been working since 7 a.m. today. It's midday and he just got his second passenger. He says that for the economy to pick up again, the change needs to come from the top.
The president, she has to go. The solution has to come from up there, not from down here. If she stays in power, things will not get better. I believe that if she goes, business people will start investing again. They will start believing in the country again.
Impression on the streets is hard to gauge, but in Congress, the state of Maranhão has spoken out overwhelmingly against President Rousseff. Most of the state's MPs were part of the ruling coalition just a few weeks ago and voted to open the impeachment proceedings against Rousseff in the lower house of Congress. Whether the people of Maranhão support President Rousseff or not, one thing almost everyone has in common. This shopkeeper, who has lost many clients due to the crisis, sums up the feeling.
If she goes and the person who takes over is Michel Temer, it won't work. Things will not change.
One poll suggests that 68% of Brazilians agree with that idea, that Brazil's vice president is not up to the job of improving the economy. As he promises a host of tough measures, with more austerity to come, it will be a while before any politician regains the trust of the people, here in Maranhão and across Brazil.
That's the BBC's Daniel Gallas in Brazil. Ago, you heard me talk with Chrissy Clark, the senior correspondent for our Wealth and Poverty Desk, and we played a little bit of our new Marketplace podcast called The Uncertain Hour. It looks at the welfare system 20 years after Bill Clinton promised to end welfare as we know it. In the first episode, you met some of welfare's most passionate reformers, including a man known as the Magic Bureaucrat. Today, an excerpt of the next episode. We go from the reformers to, well, the reformed upon. And hear the story of how welfare changed over the years through the eyes of one woman who became an unlikely civil rights pioneer. Here's Chrissy Clark.
My name is Ruby Duncan.
And how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, that's no problem. I tell that all the time. I'm 83 at the moment.
Ruby has a big smile and looks you straight in the eye when she talks to you. Like she wants to make sure you understand exactly what she thinks before she moves on. She gets around mostly in a wheelchair now, but she's spent most of her life on her feet, picking cotton, cleaning houses. She's been a hotel maid, a barmaid. Back in the late 60s, she worked at the Sahara Casino in Las Vegas, in one of the kitchens there, prepping food for thousands of people a day.
1,200 salads made in a hurry. 160 gallons of coffee. So I was pretty swift. I did a great job.
One morning, Ruby was in the middle of her regular routine, racing back and forth from the pantry to her station in the kitchen, balancing a platter loaded with food, when?
As I was coming back, I slipped.
On some cooking oil that had spilled. She fell hard.
And I didn't know at the moment what had really happened. They helped me up.
It turned out she'd done severe damage to her spine. She was in and out of the hospital for more than a year.
2 knee replacements, a hip replacement, 4 back surgeries. I really messed myself up.
The injuries made it impossible to be on her feet all day, working a kitchen job, or pretty much any other job she could find at the time, as a woman who'd never finished high school. While her union and her employer battled it out over whether to pay her disability, she tried to figure out how, with no current income, to support her 7 kids on her own. Her children's fathers were out of the picture.
So therefore, I've become a welfare recipient.
You can still hear in her voice how uncomfortable she felt about this new label after having worked since she was 8 years old. But she would be a welfare recipient on and off for years as her kids grew up, working a little, then going back on welfare when the pain from her injury would get too bad. And she hated it.
I hated welfare, to be fair with you. I really hated it. You're talked down to and you really are completely always stressed out.
And Ruby's stress and her hatred of the system only increased when she learned something one day as she was doing her grocery shopping.
What happened was on the first of the month, the stores are crowded.
The first of the month being the day when families usually got their welfare checks.
And you can tell who the welfare recipients were because the carts begin to start filling up as much as possible. And so women began to talk to each other, and we would talk about, you know, as we conversating, we would say, well, how much do you get and how large are your family?
Turns out the white women she talked to were getting more welfare benefits
than the black welfare mothers.
I'll get back to Ruby's story soon. But let me just step back for a moment to put it in some context. Because the thing you need to know about Ruby's discovery is that it was not unique. It wasn't just a fluke about the women she talked to in that grocery store in Las Vegas. For many decades, dating back to its inception in the 1930s, discrimination in the welfare system was a defining fact of the welfare system. It was written into guidelines at various welfare offices across the country, including the one where a woman named Nancy Humphreys worked in Los Angeles. She later became a professor of social work. But back in the 1960s...
I worked as an intake worker for the first year of my employment.
And Nancy says some of the forms she had to fill out when she signed families up for welfare were based on these discriminatory rules.
I saw them. I wrote them out. I complained about doing it. I said, this isn't right. And they said, those are the rules. You looked on a chart, and if a mother was applying for herself and three children, there was a white column and a black column. It was just the way the rules were set up. There was this assumption that black families could get along with less and white families needed a little more.
You know, it's interesting. There was really only a tiny trickle of African Americans on the rolls for a long time.
Kathy Eden is a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins. She's been studying the welfare system for most of her career. And she says up through the end of the 60s, states didn't just give black families fewer benefits than white families. They also made it harder for them to get welfare benefits in the first place.
States had clever ways of keeping blacks off the rolls.
Part of it was the kinds of things that you had to talk about.
Here's Nancy Humphreys again, who worked in the LA welfare office. She says they were told to ask invasive questions that discouraged women from applying for welfare.
You had to ask people about how often they had sex.
Literally, you would ask that?
Yes, you were supposed to find out how often they had had sex and over what period of time.
Another tactic to keep black families off the rolls, sociologist Kathy Eden says, was something called the good housekeeping test.
In which caseworkers would literally don white gloves and come into your dwelling and run their fingertips across the top of your fireplace mantle or your windowsill, and they would look at their fingers and see if they could see any dust. And if they did, they could exclude you. It was essentially a completely discretionary system where you could exclude someone for any reason, but you could sort of couch it under the good housekeeping test.
And then there were the midnight raids. This was in the days when only single mothers were eligible for welfare. Two-parent families didn't qualify, even if the father was unemployed or earning so little that the family was still poor. And to make sure a mother was really single, a squad of welfare workers would sometimes make surprise visits to recipients' houses.
After midnight, sometimes 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning.
Nancy Humphreys, the welfare worker, had colleagues. It was usually the men in the office who did these midnight raids.
You pounded on the door and you couldn't be denied entry. I mean, they would break the door down if necessary to get into the house.
If a man was found in the house, or just a man's belt or razor or large-sized shoe, the family could be kicked off welfare.
And often there were efforts to prosecute them for fraud, of having received benefits illegally.
All these rules, intermittently and subjectively enforced, had the effect of making the welfare system, as one civil rights leader at the time put it, a sieve with holes in it just big enough for the majority of Black families to fall through. Which brings us back to Ruby Duncan, the reluctant welfare recipient in Las Vegas, as she learned about the discrimination built into the welfare system.
I then began to hate the welfare system more. That's how I began to start organizing.
She saw it as an extension of the civil rights movement, the welfare rights movement.
Welfare rights was organizing women and making sure that all the different women throughout the community did not let the welfare department impose upon them.
Ruby and a handful of her friends started knocking on doors, finding other women on welfare.
We become stronger and stronger, by women by the hundreds.
They worked with lawyers to file lawsuits against the welfare department, demanding equal rights and equal treatment for Black recipients, and more job training for all recipients, so they could find higher-paying jobs. Or, in Ruby's case, a job that didn't require her to be on her feet all day. But there was resistance.
Then we all got together. I say we. I don't like saying I. Although I was the one that said, well, let's march on them.
And they stormed the welfare department.
Now, stay here and let this man know that you don't like what happened.
At the same time, similar welfare rights efforts in the street and in the courts were happening all over the country. This is a recording of a welfare rights gathering in Newark, New Jersey in 1967. And over the next few years, these organizing efforts worked. The white glove tests, the midnight raids, the man in the house rules were all thrown out or deemed unconstitutional. And in that time, something interesting happens. The number of people on cash welfare nearly triples.
So you see this sort of ballooning of welfare.
Here's sociologist Kathy Eden again.
In part, because this is a time in which people who are eligible actually claim their entitlement to cash aid. They were always out there, but they were excluded.
I've been thinking about that word Kathy Eden just said, entitlement, a lot lately.
Their entitlement to cash aid.
It's such an interesting and slippery word in the history of welfare. Today, the word entitlement has become synonymous with a sense of unearned privilege or selfishness. But entitlement also has this older, drier legal definition, a government program with benefits that aren't subject to budgetary discretion, that are entitled, written into law, and therefore a government benefit that people who are eligible under that law have a claim to. In the late 60s and 70s, welfare rights activists like Ruby Duncan fought to gain access to that entitlement as a civil right, and the welfare rolls grew. And as they grew and had a much more diverse set of recipients, the whole welfare system got a lot more scrutiny.
We don't want to turn that safety net into a hammock.
We've taught people that you get paid off if you are helpless.
Today we are ending welfare as we know it. But I hope this day will be remembered not for what it ended, but for what it began.
To hear the rest of the story and learn about how a good housekeeping test influenced the welfare rolls, subscribe to The Uncertain Hour wherever you get your podcasts. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we want to hear about the wedding gifts you asked for. What do you still use? What's the most unusual thing you asked for? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Chris Clark and Ben Tolliday are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.